What's up, everyone?
Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome back to the Pale Blue Dot.
Peter's back.
Hey, second episode.
I'm back. Yeah, sorry. Yes. I was sick. I did not have the coronavirus. I did not. You know, okay, so have you guys.
A likely story.
Yeah, a likely story. Well, dude, I would be like deathly ill right now if I had the coronavirus. You know? That's well, maybe okay, I fair. Do. Yeah. I do, and I just drank like 7 cups of coffee and like just hit the oxygen tank super hard. This is how much I care about this show, guys, that I would come on with the coronavirus and just phone it in. No. Have you guys ever done the PCR test?
No. What is that?
No. I
haven't. Okay. So this is a sidebar medical story, but I had it was some sort of infection that I had, you know, and I was just like, I had some like mild, like pain in my side of my stomach. I was like, okay, I must've gotten like food poisoning and it like got worse. So I went to my doc and like those symptoms are just normal infection symptoms, but they are also COVID symptoms because everything now is a COVID symptom, right? If your eyebrow itches immediately, you just think of COVID, like your hair, like you have a hair falls out in your shower, you start screaming hysterically that you have COVID and everyone in your family walks away from you, you know, like it's, So anyway, she's just like, I don't think so. But maybe you have COVID. And then she brought that up as like, fuck, why did you tell me that? So I literally couldn't sleep. And I was just like, okay, I'm getting a PCR test. And then, you know, my folks are like, you are not getting a PCR test because you don't have, you know, the symptoms. And I'm just like, I'm getting it for my own psychological well-being because I need to know. I need that negative result. Like, you know? And so then I go and it's like this giant lineup of people who probably have COVID. So you're like worried about that. And then they are like, okay, change your mask like 3 times in line. You like change your mask and they like give you new masks with like a fucking metal like tongs that they like sanitize in between.
Wow.
It's just like so like very, but you feel good. Like you feel good about that. You're like, wow, they take this very seriously. And there's all the plastic sheets and stuff. And then you like stand on these little like circular like areas that's like distance, but you have to stand inside your little pod circle and you're like distance, but then it's like, pod 2, go to, it's like Blade Runner all of a sudden. You're like in Blade Runner, you know, and they just treat you like you're a subhuman, like you are a piece of garbage. You cannot talk.
Herded.
Yeah. Unit 745, do not talk. You are in lane 2. Go to subsection C, you know? And then you go in the doctor's like little, you know, room with the, you know, plastic. And the guy's like, okay, take off your mask. I'm like, okay, hold the phone. You've gone through all this procedure. And now every single person coming in this facility is taking off their mask to do like, aren't I going to get COVID from that? And he's like, that is a good point, but I don't think I'm just like, what?
So I take off my mask. The nose thing where
they did that. Yeah. And I was like, okay, look, I don't like needles. I don't like any of this stuff. Just tell me what it feels like. And then I can mentally prepare myself. He's like, it's like going upside down in a swimming pool and having water come up your nose.
Oh God.
And it was exactly like that. And I was like, wow, okay, he told me, and so it wasn't bad. So
yeah, that is like the number one thing that that would make me squirm. So yeah, I really hope
yeah. I don't so have to no, like I was like sick with that, and then I had, you know, antibiotics. So when you take antibiotics, it kind of screws up your stomach. So anyway, I was sick last week.
All right.
And I don't have COVID.
Glad to have you back.
Don't have
COVID. Yeah. Okay, that's the important part. You don't have COVID.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
So we are very glad to have you back for this
episode. Episode number 2. Yeah, we're doing a deep dive on finance and a lot of stuff. We thought about this because there's a lot of stuff in the news about, you know, trading and GameStop and all that sort of stuff. So we're kind of like, okay, let's figure out like the broader strokes of how all this stuff works, a little bit of history. We're very excited.
Yeah.
Yeah. The episode subtitle will be otherwise known as Death and Taxes. So
death, two things certain in life is death and taxes. Also the name of my favorite bar in Toronto.
Death and Taxes.
Oh yeah. Have we been to that bar before?
I think we went. Yeah. It's really good. They, you know, very hipster. Really nice death place. And Taxes is cheeky, right?
Yeah. So kicking it off with the history, bit of history of finance. It started as, you know, most things do with the Babylonians. They Hammurabi set down the first laws of banking, like who can lend money, who can't lend money. I think it was actually banned for most of Babylonia's history. So It really only kicked off once.
Yeah, I mean, like you had a lot of like before you had like, you know, finance or you had any sort of, you know, sense of centralized banking, you had basically bartering and trading, right? Mm-hmm. And like it wasn't until, I don't even know what, I should know the dates, but like we didn't have the number zero for the longest time because it wasn't useful for hunter-gatherers. So it's like you have a cow, you give the cow to somebody else and they give you 5 chickens or whatever the equivalency they established, but they didn't have this idea of this nothing. Like why, like it's not useful for us to have nothing of something. Then all of a sudden they came with this number zero. And when they did that, suddenly you had debt. It's like, well, you owe me a cow. And I was like, what the hell? Like, what? Like I owe you like forever, like a cow. Like, how am I going to get a cow? Holy cow. I owe this guy a cow. He's like, no, your daughter is fine. Just give me your daughter and you don't forget about the cow. You know? It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's really funny to think of like the combinations of things they would have to give instead.
Right. They're like, ooh, I want 3 chicken, 1 cow, and 2 daughters. He's like, no, 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 1 daughter, okay? And they're haggling about the number of daughters they have to. And they're like lumped in with livestock. Like, that's how sexist it was in history, right?
Yeah,
the dowry would come with a cow. It's like, okay, you want to marry my daughter, you gotta give me a cow for it or for her.
That is very imbalanced system there.
Zero meant debt, and also like they didn't really have like, you know, money of today. They had all these crude like financial instruments, right? Like they had like shells at one point were a currency, like clay tablets, right?
Yeah.
The Mayans had to trade.
I remember reading a really interesting story about the making of the records of the banking records in Babylonia. So they had to make like a little mark on a soft clay tablet, and then they had to bake the tablet in order to make sure it was, you know, it was firm and set in stone.
Right.
What if you made a mistake on that thing? Like, oh no, we got to take it out quick before it's
right.
Before
oh it's shit, he time. Owes 6,000 goats. Well, hey, too late. It's been baked in. It's like, damn it.
So, that's how you end up owing 6,000. That's how you ended up broke, basically.
That's how you get the origins of things like writing. Those, because like writing was originally meant to demarcate however much it was that you were gaining from a harvest or something like that. It was like the first system to keep.
Well, that's it too. Like, like census, like the idea of collecting information, collecting data. And, you know, what people, different people owed, right? Or what different people had, you know, that was a big part of, you know, big part of the early finance. Also, it was like predominantly, you know, the three religions of the time was, you know, Islam and Christianity and Judaism. They had the practice of usury, which was the idea of loaning money for interest. So historically, a lot of religious groups did not allow this practice of usury, but some religions amended that to allow for usury, where you could loan money for interest to non-members of that particular religious group. And that led to a lot of religious prejudice of different groups because those people were faulted for gaining money off interest. They even have a Shakespeare play like Merchant of Venice, and that was based off of this idea of usury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where the Jews could lend money to Gentiles.
I think
they
had that. I think they had that like at every point in history. Like they had, you know, I think Islamic people were doing this, like Christians, but like they had different rules come into place at different times, right? So I'm not sure if it was only like Judaism that had usury, or whether it's like Christians had it for a time and then it went away.
It was originally a job that was marketed to Judaism.
Well, I think that didn't lead to usury. That's a byproduct. Like usury led to what you're talking about.
Right.
Like we know historically that a lot of people, you know, in Judaism, like had positions in finance. And that was partially attributed to usury. And that's what, so says Niall Ferguson. Have you guys read his book, A Scent of Money? It's really good. It's like a history of finance, which sounds so boring, but it's actually really interesting. A lot of wars were won based on, you know, certain financial decisions.
Yeah, and they brought down Al Capone by examining his finances.
Yeah.
So.
Well, like, yeah, one thing, like, that was interesting was, like, he was talking about the Battle of Waterloo was interesting because there was a theory that one of the Rothschilds had information about the outcome of the war. And, of course, bonds, the reason why we have bonds was traditionally to finance wars. So people would loan money to the government, and based upon the volatility of that bond would be the return on that investment once the war was over. That's what they're called, war bonds, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you knew the outcome of the war, then you had a tremendous position to bet on the bond market and make, like, billions of dollars.
Yeah.
Which is one of the theory is what one of the in Niall Ferguson's book is what one of the Rothschilds did, is that he had a legion of spies, and one of the spies knew the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo, which was one of the most significant battles, and he brought it back to the son, who then made a massive position on the bond market and made, like, billions of dollars in a day, or like that equivalent of money.
So that's how the family made its fortune.
Well, that's one of the theories in Niall Ferguson's book anyways. Like, he says, you know, like, there's different historical accounts of this, but that's one of the main ones. Another really interesting one is that traditionally they say that the Battle of Gettysburg was the big turning point in the Civil War. And Niall Ferguson makes the argument in his book that it was actually a smaller battle that impeded the flow of cotton out of the South to France. So I can't remember what that battle was called, but essentially the French were the only ones at the time during the Civil War buying the cotton, and the whole Southern economy was backed by cotton. So instead of backing by gold, which a lot of countries did, they didn't have gold, so they backed their financial instruments to cotton with cotton-backed bonds. And when they couldn't get the cotton out to Europe, the economy collapsed, so they didn't have the subsequent funds to finance the war.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So he makes the argument that the Battle of Gettysburg was irrelevant.
That is, yeah.
So there's all these, like, hidden, stuff.
Yeah, the stuff you run into when you look at finance from a historical perspective is the places it's influenced history is not the place, are not the places you would expect. Like, they're little nooks and crannies that no one's ever talked about.
Yeah, the pen is mightier than the sword, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, the interesting thing too is, like, a lot of wars were fought over resources, because the resources were the material basis for the whole economy, because all of the ledgers and the balance sheets were based on these finite resources, that the whole financial structure was based off of that. So everything was pegged to a real value. Like, that's why they have the gold standard, and they had other standards for history, whether it's spices or salt. Like, the word for salary is salt, because, like, the Roman soldiers were paid in salt.
Yeah, which was a rare resource at the time, and they had a lot of value.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's where.
And then some reason that the Americans decided to repeal the gold standard.
Yeah, that's curious. That's kind of strange to me. Like, why would they choose to repeal the gold standard?
Well, I think it just frees up a lot more economic capital, because you could basically just have these monetary bubbles, like this infinite promise of money, so the economy could just go crazy because it's not tied to any real value.
Right. And if you this actually is jogging my memory. I think I read somewhere that all the gold in the world would only come out to like $3 trillion worth of
money.
Right. Yeah.
And so then they just keep really printing money, and they get inflation, and like then you get like hyperinflation.
Oh yeah, like post World War II, when the franks had, using
it as like wallpaper.
Yeah, you have a. I remember reading.
Imagine wiping your ass with like 100 francs.
That's pretty normal.
It's like, oh, I gotta go to the bathroom. Like, don't use the good stuff. That's the good toilet paper. Use the francs. Use the money, for God's sakes. We've lost everything. Right.
It's actually one of the things that happens with like Venezuela's currency, that it like the value is so low that like it's worth less than toilet paper. And so, like, I've seen artists use it as like material for their work and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's the weirdest thing. Cool. Like in Japan, they like went into hyperinflation. I can't remember the exact reasons for this, but like when I was there, it's like you buy something, it's like 5,000 yen. You're like, $5,000 for this? Yeah. It's like a fucking apple or something. It's literally like an apple. And it's like, whatever. Or like you buy a drink at a bar, it's like 10,000 yen. You're like, this is $10,000? Right?
And God, but then the other thing is like a loaf of bread.
Their change is like 500 yen is like a coin.
Yeah.
So you're like, you know what I mean? Like if you give someone like $10,000 and they give you back change, you're like suspicious, you know? Even though like, you know, I'm kind of like, what, man? Like what are you ripping me off? The guy's like, I didn't rip you off. Like everything's fine. I'm like, what is all this change in the account? I'm like, oh yes, I'm an idiot. Like I'm, and I got the, I'm like, thank you. I'm sorry. You know, like I just give him 10,000 and he just gives me a bunch of coins. I'm like, this guy is definitely ripping me off. But he was not.
There's one place where I think it's Zimbabwe that like the hyperinflation there is like so bad that they have
$1 trillion or something. Yeah, like. It's like $1 million orange. Yeah. Well, one that was really funny is like there was an article I was reading that was called The $1 Million Pizza. So this guy back in the 90s, like this is like, and this is what my friend's like wife was telling me. When you first bought a digital wallet in the 90s, they give you 3 free Bitcoins. Imagine that. Everyone like had a chance of $90,000, or like now it's like $120,000. You would have gone for free just to download a digital wallet to your stupid, you know, PC, right? So this guy got like, I think it was like 3 free Bitcoins. He's like, oh, this is kind of fun. Okay, I'm going to buy some Bitcoin and just spend some money on stuff for my kids. Because he wanted to teach his kids about, you know, and just have fun. So he bought a pizza with Bitcoin and it cost him 25 Bitcoin. That would have been worth like $1 million today or something.
Oh,
he's just like putting his foot in his mouth. He's like this Floridian guy.
There's all these stories of people that had like backed up like millions of Bitcoins on their computer, but they just ended up deleting them because they had no value at the time. But then it shot up and then. Nothing.
Well, they're just like now they're saying Bitcoin is worth even more than gold.
Yeah. There was hearing an interesting story from my brother about how major countries like the U.S., China, Russia, they were buying up as many CPUs as they could so that they could mine Bitcoins, which basically means.
Yeah.
Each Bitcoin has a digital identity, right? And you can figure it out through brute force computer processing. So they were trying to make themselves richer by calculating these Bitcoin identities and then cashing them in on the market.
Yeah. People have these massive like Bitcoin operations, but it's like you need so much gear for that. And like, I don't even kind of really know how it works, but like you need a ton of these mainframes and it's like generates so much energy. You probably take out your whole power grid and your block by doing that.
Yeah.
But like the other thing,
farms would it be the size of my house?
The other thing that's really interesting too, and me and Gowdy were having a conversation about this. There's this guy I found out about on Instagram called Beeple. And this guy is doing VR, AR simulations for like rock concerts and like music concerts, right? So like all these artists, they have like graphics above their whatever pyrotechnics display. And so this dude, he was just like a regular dude and he works like as a web developer, whatever. But he started doing these dailies. So every day he'd do these graphic renderings of things and put them out on Instagram. And over like 5 years, he'd done like 10,000 of them. And, you know, I think, I don't know what number of them, maybe it was like 1,000, 2,000. He got contracted to do these big shows. Like he got Lady Gaga, he got Eminem, he got like big celebrity names. Like, you know, he's doing like graphics. Yeah, but it's still like pretty.
He's done stuff for still, like Apple, Louis Vuitton,
right, Apple, like yeah. So he's like the biggest ever in something like super niche, right? So everyone's like, who freaking knew that, right? So, but the whole time he's like, okay, I'm making like a bit of change on the side doing these concerts, right? Like he'd make a lot of money, but like he's not getting that much. But then they created these types of, it's not a Bitcoin so much as like a codec to like a digital signature. For art. So basically it's like a Bitcoin where you can independently authenticate your digital file with this. which effectively makes all digital art the same as real art.
Yeah.
So he had this digital signature technology called like CMF, and he puts it on his stuff, and now he's got 15,000 pieces of art as a backlog, and like one of them was selling for $750,000 in one day. Guy's got 15,000 of those, right? And he's got his credibility of like Lady Gaga, whatever. So before he couldn't sell them because anyone could just copy the stuff. Now he made $1 million in a single day because he was selling at auction his stuff with this Bitcoin technology.
That's incredible. I think that, yeah.
But the margins is like, you look like not even impressive for him, but like there's traders, there's like people, this is super like niche. And like, I looked into it. I don't know how it works yet, but it's like, the margins are like 3,000% on, like someone will buy his art with a digital signature and they'll hold on to it for like a day and they bought it for like $2,000 and it's worth like $16,000 like 2 days from then. So it's just like going up the chain. It's just like, it's crazy.
It's like regular art, visual art trading.
What's it? Like I, you know,
accelerated to like 1,000 times.
Yeah. Like it's sort of like what your pain threshold is for each individual. Right. So like as a student, probably your pain threshold is like $300. Like that's not an outrageous amount of money to lose. You're not going to be crying over it, but you're going to be kind of like pissed. Or maybe it's five, you know, whatever. Everybody's different. But it's like, it might be interesting. You have, you know, $200, whatever you're willing to lose in like a night out drinking with your friends. Not that we can do that anymore. But hey, you probably saved a lot of money from that. So, you know, try this CMF thing. You know, I was thinking I'd buy it for $200, whatever.
He sells some of his hold pieces on to it. For like just a dollar, but they go really quickly. Like
in what I'm saying. Yeah. He sells it for a dollar, and then it goes like $10 in 10 days, and it's like, you know, $40, and then like a month later, it's like $1,000. You know,
yeah.
So it's just like, you know, it, on the low end, it's like who cares? It's more of a YOLO purchase, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think it would be kind of fun to do that. There was another article too in The Guardian that people are using old music as stocks now. So people are trading
in old music.
Like yeah, so this the guy rights
of music.
It's like the recordist rights and the publishing rights. But they create these companies that are basically like hedge funds. So imagine you have a hedge fund and you have a bunch of investors that go together as like a lion's share to buy the rights to an old song from like the 60s. And so they have all this metadata of like songs and trends and how they're going to come back and all this stuff. And they buy stuff out. Like there's one, it was like from the 1960s. That's like super popular on like Valentine's Day or something. And there's another one for Christmas. They bought the rights to it and they made all their money back in those 2 days based on the radio play.
Damn.
You know, the guy's saying it's incredible. Like worth more than gold. Like, you know, and it's like, if you know which songs, the guy was like a record executive or something. So he really has his finger on the pulse of music. But it's just like every time, like, it's like something like 18% for the recordist and then like 12% for the publisher or something like that. Every time it gets a play. But now with streaming, it's even better than it was with just the records because you have a whole passive audience. And anytime someone clicks on the song, like there's people being paid.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's by accident, somebody makes money.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So they're how just do I get like, they're,
on this?
Yeah, they're just buying that.
Yeah. Music becoming the new gold standard. That's so strange. I don't think any science fiction writer.
Well, he's saying it's like economy proof. Cause he's like, look, like if it's economic expanse, economic collapse, people still need to be happy. And that when they're sad, they want to listen to music. When they're happy, they want to listen to music. When they're excited, they want to listen to music. He's like, guess what? I own the whole catalog. Ha, ha, ha. He's like Mr. Burns. You know what I mean? He's like making money off people's joy.
Yeah. Like, that's what Hans, what's his name? Hans Zimmer, the guy who does the music for Inception.
Right.
Yeah. He said that it, you know, at the end of the day, even after we built all the tallest, we built all the fastest machines, all of the tallest high rises, there's still going to be room for music and story, and I think that's definitely true, especially if it becomes the new currency.
Well, I don't think it's gonna like take over as a currency so much as just like a thing that people trade, you know, like baseball cards. But it's like it's kind of interesting. Like, it's intriguing that they would do that. I didn't even think about that until I read the article. And that, like, the other thing too is, like, it's one thing for just, like, I knew of, like, people that you could call, like, Scrooges, that are just like dicks that just buy shit and hold on to the patent like crabs, or like a, or like a troll, like a, you know, troll bridge kind of thing, where people will buy out websites, you know, of like things they think are going to be popular, like, rawr, you have to pay me out. You know, I've heard of that, and that's what I thought these music people were doing, right? They just buy it out just to piss off the record labels, and then they have to buy them out. But no, these guys are getting a bunch of people together to all, as a cooperative, purchase these old songs and hold on to them and then be the new owners. And it's not like they're trying to screw anybody over. They're like the curators of these songs. Like, they want these songs to be popular. They're trying to sell them to all these radio stations again. So it's like, not only, yes, they are profiting, but they're also trying to popularize these older songs that might be kind of going the way of the dinosaur. They're trying to bring them back alive. So it's actually kind of cool, because then you have the general populace going to bat for these songs that otherwise nobody else is going to bat for them. And they have a financial interest to do that. Right? So if you own stake in that song, you're calling up the radio station, hey, what do you think about playing, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, they're like trying to make it like great again, you know, popularize
it. The days of pay to play almost, but almost in reverse, sort of.
Yeah, I don't know. And there's so many of these schemes they got. And then the ultimate one is the GameStop thing. I mean, I don't know how much time we have left in the program, but we definitely got to talk about that.
We have 3 more minutes left.
Shoot. Okay. So, Gaudi, let's do the quickest summary that you can surmise, because you're the resident Redditor.
So,
the resident Redditor.
I guess to give like the most like boiled down version of it was that... basically, in stocks, one thing that you can do is called shorting stocks, which is when a company is failing, you can borrow stock from that company and sell it at market price, expecting for the price of that stock to go down, for you to be able to buy it back at a lower price, and then you get to keep the difference, basically. What was happening was that since coronavirus is happening and all of this has been going on, GameStop, which was like the old video game retail store, was failing. And along with things like AMC, which is like the company of the movie theaters, was also failing.
Motorola.
Yeah. And this subreddit called Wall Street Bets, which basically all they do is like do all of these meme, like telling people to buy stock and then to do so. And then they got a bunch of people together, and they all pooled their resources into buying GameStop stock, which completely like boosted the value of the stock, forcing hedge funds to cover their shorts, which means that they have to like put up the capital to be able to pay back and buy back those stocks from to give them back to the company. And basically this cost this ended up costing hedge funds over like $10 billion or something like that.
Short squeeze. Yeah, short they got squeeze. Screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Revenge. Yeah. So I mean, like, on its head, like, the reason why it was such a huge story, because it was kind of a David versus Goliath thing. Now, this is being very disputed, but the original narrative was like a bunch of like nerds on Reddit took on Wall Street and won. So that's why it was such a sensational story. But like, ostensibly, there's way more to it than that, because we don't know whether these characters were actually implicated with Silicon Valley traders, whether this was some sort of insider job, whether there was any fraud or collusion, right? It's very hard to tell.
Yeah, the issue now is that it's basically become like a pyramid scheme, or like a Ponzi scheme, I mean. Because like now they're just getting people to buy into it at any cost without them realizing that like they're buying into something and they're gonna be left holding the bag.
Yeah. Well, that's the classic like pump and dump, right? And so, you know, but yeah, it's all good until someone loses an eye, and then
exactly
basically 30 minutes. That was perfect.
Wow. Okay. Well, that was pretty fast. So, thank you guys for listening. I think we should do a part two on this.
Yeah, this could definitely be a part two.
Yeah. Well, I know someone who works in banks and stuff, so I should talk to her and. You know, see if we can get her on, or at least, you know, maybe we'll do do a call, or I can pick her brain about some interesting things to do with finance for round two.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
All right, excellent. Thank
it's
you.
Way more to this GameStop thing.
Thank you everybody for joining us.
Yeah, thanks everyone for joining us. And do we know what our theme is next week, or we'll announce? Yeah,
next
midweek. I think we'll figure it out in the interim, probably.
Yeah.
In the interim, shall be decided. Right. Okay.
Yes.
Stay safe, everyone.
Yes. Yeah, stay healthy. Peace.